Welcome to the Matador Revisionist History Podcast, the history of Matador Records told by the artists who made it, or maybe they just made it all up. Today, we're joined by Peter Visser and Carol van Dyk of the masterful Dutch band Betty Severt, who released Palomine, their debut album, on Matador 30 years ago. I was there for that. My name's Matt Sweeney. I was around. I'm very excited when that record came out, and I'm excited to talk about it, because that album is back in print on LP this year with some B-sides and demos from that era. And I had a chance to talk to Carol and Peter about the first trip from Amsterdam to New York City, Matador in the early 90s, everything that went into Palomine, and it was so much fun talking to them. This is a really, really, really special band and a really great record, so hope you dig it. This is actually something that I have never experienced, so I
keep it that way.
Nothing to offer as a response.
I didn't know you liked science fiction.
I don't like science fiction, but the fourth dimension is something that Marcel Duchamp, my artist hero, was really into in 1912.
What was Duchamp's fourth dimensional?
Brothers were part of the Puteau group, as they called themselves, and every Sunday they had a gathering and they talked about the fourth dimension. It was kind of a hype thing to talk about in groups of painters.
And was the fourth dimension some sort of was it a spiritual, psychological realm, or what?
Basically,
what were they speaking about?
It was interesting to talk about, but nobody really knew. So everybody came up with their own version of what it was.
They were just high.
Yeah, so you can make any story of it, whatever you like.
Right, got it. That's fucking cool. All right, so Palomine, it was so great. I'm really happy that I could talk to you guys about that record.
Thank you.
And I guess that time, because that record really stood out, and you guys stood out for me in a really huge way, mainly because you were and remain such a band, and the record still has this great organic, rock solid feel and real agreement between the musicians. That's for me super rare to hear. So I guess we could start at the top. What I know is that when Matador Records, when Chris and Gerard got together, they made a list of bands that they wanted to sign, like a fantasy list, and that D. Artson was I think the first band that they wrote down.
Really?
But I mean, they were obviously, they had their ears to the underground, you know?
Yeah,
but
definitely.
Underground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even in Holland, they weren't really well known.
What could have been the case is that a friend of ours had business with Gerard before Matador happened, and they might have exchanged LPs or something like that.
That makes sense. And also, Chris and Gerard both worked for Dutch East India Trading Company, which was a record distributor.
Yeah. And our friend here in Holland was also working for some distribution center.
There you go.
That's our answer.
So it went from them, you know, from them putting this obscure Dutch band on their fantasy list of this of their fantasy label that they were making to Chris told me that they found out that D. Artson was no more, but that you had a new thing going on.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so how was it that, did you just get a call from Gerard or something like that? Or how did the meeting happen?
No, it was a friend, Hans van den Berg, who was sending records towards Matador. And he put in our first demo with a little note saying something like, two of these band members used to be in the arts, and please don't throw this away. Something like that. So you might want to hear this. And that's another question that we also have. The legend is that after they heard our demo, they jumped on a plane to see us play here in Amsterdam. And it was the legend says, the story says, 4 days after they heard the demo.
Were you doing D'Artson and Betty Sevier sort of at the same time?
Kind of.
It was conceptually? That, conceptually.
D'Artson were not really an all-time touring band. So there was once in a while we had a show.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, for the last couple of years of D'Artson, Berend and Carolyn and I got together once in a while with cassette decks and a couple of microphones and our little instruments and started making songs where everybody, the three of us, made a song within 1 hour and then we performed it, we recorded it, except I was really bad at it and Carol was pretty good songwriter, as we found out then. And so when the Artson split up, we continued with the three of us. And then
at
a certain point, we went to the practice space. And a while later, because Berend used to be a drummer when he was a kid, but he was more like a talented, like every instrument, like the Brian Jones kind of guy. You give him an instrument and he within half an hour he can play decent on it, or kind of decent. So, but then,
or make a good sound or whatever. Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. But so then we thought of, well, maybe we could start being a band, or maybe do a show once a year or whatever. And then Berend had to return to the drum kit, which he was not really fond of.
No, he wanted to play bass and keyboards, actually. Mm-hmm. And then have another drummer.
Yeah. But then we were asking Herman, and to our surprise, he said yes, because it was kind of totally different music from the Artson. And so that's kind of the beginning.
But there was, for like 5 or 6 months, end 86, beginning of 87, when we were still living in Arnhem, there was a band called Betty Sevier with a Y.
Just was that because that book was so popular? I'm surprised.
No. It was us with another
drummer. Oh, I see. Oh, okay. I thought it was a different band.
It was a different band. I mean, the songs were completely different. The repertoire was absolutely different. And half of the songs were sung by this guy.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Those recordings are
forbidden,
stashed away, and
right,
never to be found again.
I still
incinerated. what was I have so many questions because I'm a casual fan of Dutch rock. I'm only saying that because there's so much of it, and I don't know a lot about it. So I, to an American, I'd say I'm a big fan of Dutch rock, but since you guys, you know.
Wow.
Just like the Outsiders are one of my favorite groups of all time.
Okay. Den Haag.
And
they did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, they're Amsterdam.
Yeah. Because Wally Tox.
Wally Tox grew up in Amsterdam.
He lived across the bridge.
Really, from where you live.
Because when I did my walkings around, he came from the other, because I live in the east, but he lived a little bit further in the east. So, but he was already in a bad shape by then.
Yeah, I know. He had a rough go of it at the end. But there's, to me, and there music culture is really deep, and rock music culture is super deep, particularly in your city. That has always been my impression, you know, and it seems to be a fact, you know, just having so just could you maybe give us a example of growing up in Amsterdam and the particular, I know it's kind of a big broad question, but How has Amsterdam affected your take on, how did it affect your take on music?
I'm from a farmer country, east of Holland.
Okay.
And I got Amsterdam the day after I finished art school.
Okay.
So I've been to art school in Arnhem for 5 years, and then I got my diploma, which came in really handy I didn't get any job out of that, but that's what you get when you go to art school. And so then I went to Amsterdam and Carol as well. But at the time, and we're talking about 87, 89, there was a thing called the Amsterdam School. And that was a group of bands that we were not part of. Fact, we were not part of anything at all. We were kind of like on our own bubble, in our own bubble, on our own island. And basically, but I can only speak for myself, I've only felt part of a group of musicians when we went to the United States, when we met the people from Dinosaur and Buffalo Tone.
No, that was beforehand. Already in the late 80s, we started to listen to Buffalo Tom, Dinosaur Jr.
Yeah, but we were not part of
it. No, we were not part of it.
Yeah. And so the Amsterdam School, what bands would that be, like the X, or what is the
X, maybe a little bit. Blue Murder was the example of the Amsterdam School. And maybe Claw was Claw.
I don't even know that.
Were they part of it?
Were they part of it?
We were already befriended with them.
And still, yeah.
So, because I mean, your sound to me, in addition to being organic, is you know, warm and velvety, and you know, Neil Youngy and Fairport Convention. To me, these are just sort of sounds, and even back then, I was struck by what I wouldn't even say a command of that sound, but just how it naturally that sound came out of. Out of Betty Sevier. Was that what was the, when you're saying the bubble that you were in versus the bubble that or versus the Amsterdam School, was it older groups or was it modern, was it contemporary bands like Buffalo Tom and Dinosaur Jr. that you were responding
to? We were listening to Nirvana when they came out with Bleach, and they played in Amsterdam with Bleach. Dinosaur Jr., Buffalo Tom, Sonic Youth. You know, the whole...
Ramones. Especially Carol.
Yeah, big Ramones fan. Awesome. New York, Bison, Seattle. Most of the bands.
I guess what I'm asking about the sort of music culture where you were was because, again, like, in the Netherlands, the American underground music was really getting received before anywhere else, like more so in America, I think more so in England too. And when I was coming up, so I graduated high school in 1987 and I was already playing in bands and stuff and was intensely interested in the same music that you're describing. The whole thing was like Holland. You want to go over there. You want to go over to Amsterdam. Yeah. And if it plays, if people like you there, then it's going to happen. And it's funny because when I try to explain that to people now, they kind of don't believe me. You know, it was such a center and I still don't know why. Yeah. Why was it so cool there?
Okay. At least part of it, I guess. There was a booking agency in Nijmegen in Holland called Paperclip. And they got Nirvana and Ted and Dead Moon and most of the bands, because these days American whatever bands not from Holland, they do one or two shows at the most. In those days, they started at the Vera Club in Groningen in the north.
Describe the Vera Club to us, to people who don't know about the Vera Club.
The Vera Club, it's legendary.
Yeah, it's not as big as Paradiso, for instance. It's more the old room of the Melkweg, but more square, and they have their inner circle, which is they always know certain bands it's going to sell out in minutes, because the inner circle of people, their own
the hardcore
Fira
people,
yeah,
like Dead Moon. I remember Dead Moon was like the
They played it like 200 times.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like they were religious. Vera was religious. Yeah. I remember, you know, as an American indie rock fan, knowing about Vera Club from bands going over there and saying that they had their best show at Vera Club. And, you know,
yeah.
And
then
when I finally got there again, I was like, this is it, you know, because it's like, it's sort of felt like it's like a community center squat almost.
Yeah.
You know,
it used to be a squat place, right?
I don't know, but in those days you started off eating in the big hall like it was a mensa.
Oh yeah. And then they would take the tables away.
They would take the tables out, right. And the dressing room was upstairs. And
yeah.
Last year the promoter Peter Weening retired, but he was he was the guy.
And yeah, with the prong baseball hat. He always had the prong baseball hat.
Yeah, he looks exactly the same.
Awesome.
Still the plastic colorful
and the black Manchester.
Yeah. But he's still connected. I mean,
yeah.
He probably lives next door.
No, he doesn't. But
well, almost.
Well, it's his second house.
Yeah.
Almost. Yeah, and we played there with the Artson twice.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time we came on, we were all dressed up in strange gear. And the people in the audience say, "Who the fuck are you guys?" But then at the end of the show, it was kind of like, people liked it. And then we came back a second time. And that was for, same with Matador maybe, if the new band is as good as the old band, then we might be interested. And that's how
it
came about, I guess.
And plus, so, a lot of venues used to be subsidized by the state. So a lot of good clubs.
That's the other thing.
Nice dressing.
Yeah, like VPRO. Yeah. That was the other thing. It seemed like arts and music was... This is... We're talking about 80s, late 80s. We're heavily subsidized and supported, mm-hmm. you know, and so again, as an American, it was just shocking to go over there and be treated with respect. Also, see sort of a government that sort of seems to work okay, and that they've sort of figured out how to incorporate music into it, you know.
Like, and it was also, food,
yeah,
yeah, the whole thing. It was so shocking, you know, and again, like I think a lot of musicians, I was, you know, the first place that I went was Amsterdam, you know, and then played 9 million shows only in Holland, you know, like in all and Nijmegen and Groningen and all these, you know, all these places, and it makes it. I guess I just have it in my mind. I just always think of Amsterdam in particular, and that whole country is a very wired for music place, you know. And that could just be because of my own mythology, but it seems to me that everybody was better educated about rock music over there, you know. But I don't know.
It's a small country.
Did you? Right, and it's a port, and it's a port town, and all that. So there's record distribution and histories of people coming over, and you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then also things like the Paradiso being this club that every rock band played and that everybody saw and stuff. It seems like a more concentrated, I'd say, like sort of like, you know, New York or London or some of these cities that a lot of bands came out of. It seemed that there was an inordinately high concentration of music culture, you know, and kind of rock culture, you know what I mean? Meaning, you know, electric guitars and,
yeah,
you know, and that beats and stuff.
We had the feeling, if you want to go where it is happening, if you're a painter, musician, or a writer, or whatever, go to Amsterdam.
Yeah.
Because that's... Otherwise, you were in the train like 5 days a week.
Right. So, you guys make this demo, you send it to Matador, and then... Right away, there's this response.
Yeah.
Yeah. But because we only started in August 91, by December, we already had this demo tape, which, to be honest, I didn't really see the point, but, you know, why make a demo? Nobody's going to listen to it anyway.
Right.
We never had any plans. We had been in so many bands that never amounted to much. So we were like, well, maybe someday we can play at some small club, or, you know, that was the extent of our ambition. Maybe one day, one club, who knows? So we were very surprised that Matador, this cool label from New York, was all of a sudden standing in front of us, and they liked it.
And we fucked it up. That show was a horrible show.
We were so nervous. Was it really? We were supposed to play 40 minutes. I think we played the whole set in 20, 25. Like,
and then they were in the dressing room, Patrick, Gerard, and Chris. And I remember saying to them, "We're so sorry you came all the way for nothing. We fucked it up. Sorry." And the next
day, what did they say?
They said, well,
they said, "We'd rather see a band screw up than play on automatic pilot." Something like that. It's like, oh, we're good at screwing up.
So the next day, we had a meeting in our, well, where Berend lived.
Oh, yeah.
And we did not know what to expect or what we wanted. And then they said, "What do you guys want with your career or with your life?" And we said, "I don't know." And Berend had the clever state of mind to say, "We've seen New York on the television, but we've never been there.
We want to see it for real."
Wow. That would be cool.
Wow, that's so cool.
So they left. And a couple of months later, there were like 4 plane tickets brought to us by the post. And we were like, "Whoa, what's that?" Because I've never been in a plane before in my entire life. None of us
You're
were.
Fucking, no way. Wow.
I've been in a plane ever since I was 5 years old. But the three of them, the guys, had never been inside, even close to a plane. So that was really fun to see them.
Because Herman was like...
Herman was light green and shit.
Because he knows every plane accident ever with the amount of dead people.
Herman struck me as so worldly and fearless. That's really funny.
Yeah.
True, except inside a plane.
And none of us had ever been to the United States. Not even you.
No. Wow. No. Canada, obviously. But.
So whole... And we got to stay in Chris Lombardi's apartment for a week. And the end of the week was our show at the Matador Showcase in the old knitting factory.
So I saw that. I was at that show.
You were there?
Oh, yeah.
Whoa.
It was fucking killer. I remember it was killer.
Like, really?
Really strong. Yes, it was really strong. I remember, like... Also, particularly Peter's guitar was very happening. It's really funny. I remember being absolutely blown away by that show, and particularly just being like, "How the fuck do they know how to do any of this?" Like, I don't know. Like the musicality was really way ahead of bands at that time, in my opinion.
Really?
You know? And yeah. we've been
working up to that day, whole week. So we were like, "Let's do it."
Really, it was nervous. Awesome.
It was really good. But I remember like in the songs that have the big solos and stuff like that, just being like, "Jesus, they're like levitating." It was really sick. It was super, super sick. I remember seeing, I saw you guys there and at Maxwell's too. Did you play in Hoboken in New Jersey, or have I?
No, that was the plan.
No, the day after that show, we played at the Middle East in Boston, the upstairs room.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we drove back after the show. We drove back to New York. So, and then we got a call. By then it was Monday morning. We got back to the apartment in Chris's apartment, and we got a phone call. We were supposed to play it in Maxwell or Max.
Kansas City.
Was that
Max's? No, Maxwell's. It has to be. Max's Kansas City was gone by then.
That's really what I said.
In Hoboken.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we were supposed to play in Maxwell's, but we were going to borrow the drum kit from Charlie.
Charlie from Unsane, Charlie Andrus.
Yeah, from Unsane, who we had met 2 days before. And then we got the call that he passed away suddenly. And that was so sad. So the whole thing was canceled for all the bands.
Chris had mentioned that the song Palomine is somehow, at least in Chris's mind, partially related to that, or is that true?
Yeah, I started writing it because I had a super jet lag, so I would keep waking up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and the rest of the guys were just. So I started writing the song, and I had this really weird feeling that. Something serious was going to happen, like either one of us was going to die or.
So that was in the first week before those shows.
Yeah, the couple of days before. That's when I started this, the intro of the song. Plus, I was thinking about all the friends and people that I knew had either committed suicide when they were really young or drug overdose. And it was sort of like, it's a farewell. I hope you're better off now. Mm-hmm. And then that happened with Charlie. And it sort of all came together. And that's what Palomine is about. So it's partially also influenced by Charlie's death. So that's
true. Chris, I didn't know that. And it's funny, too, because... It's cool because that you guys had a connection that Betty Severt, who sound the way that you guys do, and Unsane, who sound the way that they did, you know what I mean? Like it's a real it's really cool that atmosphere was happening back then. You know what I mean?
Definitely.
And Matador had such, and they still do for that matter. But it's a very very diverse aesthetic that they had at that point. You know what I mean? Where like. Because I think Unsane was one of their very early releases. Those records still are still fucking scary sounding. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is it possible that when you played at the Knitting Factory, did Unsane play as well?
No.
Or am I crazy about that?
Okay. No.
The Knitting Factory is like where all Matador bands were playing all the time, and it was really interesting at the time seeing who Matador was going after. You know, because it would be. That none of the bands would ever sound anything like the other bands that they were interested in. There was no, Matador sound.
No.
You know.
No, but still it made sense, all the bands together.
Completely. Yeah. There was this, I think because the bands were so obviously dedicated to the sound that they, to their own sound, you know what I mean, to their own universe. And I thought in some ways Betty Severt was very advanced in that regard, again, where, like you guys said, you kind of had a bubble or an island that you had a chance to develop, you know.
But I guess that that every Matador band at the time was fan of every other Matador band
That's
at the
true.
Time. Definitely. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I remember at the Knitting Factory, there were so many people that we were like, whoa. And we were on such a high after the show, and that's where we met Tom Johnston and Richard Grable and the guys from Sonic Youth. And
they were there.
And then I remember after that, we were standing outside, and I said to Berend, what if you are dreaming and your mother is going to wake you up in 10 minutes that you have to dress and go to high school?
And it never happened. It was just a dream.
That's so cool. Yeah, I mean, again, I remember that show and it was packed and everybody was there. And to what you're saying, that's just so cool, you know, because I grew up around New York and had been seeing shows since I was 15 in New York. But that feeling of being able to come to New York and have your friggin' life changed irrevocably and in one night, and you're meeting people and you know that these people are going to be people that you're going to be messing with for the next couple of years. You know, like that was definitely that energy was there that night for sure.
Yeah, those 40 minutes are the reason that we're doing this right now.
It's cool to talk about that because I've been lucky enough to be able to do this podcast and to talk to artists who were making records for Matador back then. But that whole thing, and this is what I think is the neatest thing about rock music, is that it is about 40 minutes, and oftentimes it's 40 minutes of music that was often made up inside of 40 minutes as well.
Yeah, sometimes.
You know what I mean? And that, or you know, like, and just this intense snapshot that can reverberate for, and exactly what you're saying, like the reason that we're sitting here right now is because of a really concentrated amount of, focused amount of time that like that expression, lightning in a bottle, where so many factors, you know, come into play that create this.
Yeah, and this pure thing. Luck like as well.
Pure luck. If that if that demo hadn't been inside that box on its way to Matador, it would have only been released here in Holland on Brinkman Records. It would have gone nowhere.
It's so cool.
Because by the time we were playing in New York at the showcase, hardly anyone knew about us in Holland.
Right. Yeah. So your profile, you had an American profile before you had a local.
More or less. Yeah.
It did help to convince some people here in Holland. It's like, oh, if they like it over there, then it must be something.
And totally. And also a small degree of irony, because at that point in America, if they liked it over in Amsterdam, that meant that you were probably doing well. You know what I mean? Yep. Like for sure. There were bands. There were so many bands that had a profile in Holland that they did not have here. You know, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So were there songs on that demo that ended up on the album?
Kitzel Ride.
Tomboy. Leg, obviously.
Leg.
Right.
Valentine.
Oh, wow. Okay, so a bunch.
Valentine wasn't on the demo.
Oh.
No, we... Actually, Valentine wasn't even a Betty Zwart song. It was a Three Anikas song with Berend, the project that was before.
This Thing Nowhere, Maggot, Get the Bird, Tomboy, Kiss a Ride, and Lag.
Totally freaked up, out.
That's the demo.
That's the demo. Maggot and Get the Bird were...
Extras.
Extras now, but not back then.
Tomboy is such a cool song.
Thank you.
Barrett
wrote.
How were?
Barrett wrote the intro.
Okay, yeah. So when with, because I really think of you guys as a very very band, but I'm and I don't want to get too boring about process, but would you come into the thing like I have an idea and then you develop it like that like would you come to the band with an idea and then the band would develop it? Is that generally how it would work with your songs, or just different? Like, how did Palomine come together?
You mean the song panel?
Tomboy. Sorry, how did Tomboy come together?
Well, that was an exception because Berend was the one who came into the practice room. And he was like
the opening lick.
Yeah, I got this.
Just a lick.
He doesn't really play guitar, but he was like, I got this little thingy. Yeah, it's nice. And we were like, how do you play that? That's weird. And so that became the intro of a song, and we sort of just started jamming on it, and I think it came together really fast.
Well, it took a long time to finish because we had like 8 different parts of it, and we had to arrange that and throw stuff out and.
Yeah.
And then, I love how all of your arrangements are on that record are so cool. It's this really great mix of this organic feel, but then of really smart decisions that are sort of based on each other and sort of serving the song as opposed to,
yeah.
I don't know, nothing sounds forced, but it sounds really thoughtful. You know,
yeah.
What I mean?
Our look was that none of us had been educated in music playing. Except for Carol.
Is that right?
I had classical music training for about 7 years.
But that was theoretically?
Yeah, and reading and writing, which didn't help at all because they don't know how to read music.
Of course, yeah.
use it.
And we were very lucky that none of us had any musical lessons or training or whatever. So we could only play what our hands were doing. And and it melted the four of us together because we were friends. Mm. And so therefore you're kind of allowing the other to do what he does.
Plus Peter Berend and I sort of grew up together. We knew each other from when we were 16 or 17.
Oh, shit.
So,
okay.
A while back I visit Berend's mother, who still lives in the same apartment. It almost looks the same. She just turned 101 years old.
My God, that's
yes.
And we used to get visit each other when we were still living at home. So the bond was really tight, and we used to play together, the three of us. And then Herman came in, but Peter and Herman had been in a band, so that sort of glued together. But it was the only
that goes a long way. That really explains. Okay, now that explains why you guys are awesome. I think it, and
if you say so.
Well said. That's that. But no, but it's that band sound where and that. Thanks for letting me know that because I was like, why does the songs work so well that way?
I guess
because I think and it makes sense because I think somebody with a lot of training wouldn't come up with those arrangements. You know, they are
somebody with training would have thrown out a lot of half of the songs.
Probably.
But they work so incredibly well. Like the song just go back to Tomboy really quick. It doesn't have a chorus.
No.
So to speak.
No, it doesn't.
You know what I mean? Like but it flows so well and it satisfies, you know, and it sticks in your head immediately. You know, and I mean, I guess that's sort of what you guys do. That's a good example of sort of how your songs go, is in that they're really catchy and they have an internal logic, really, really well thought out internal logic, you know, that, but they're singular, you know?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a lot of praise. We never think about it.
That's
like that.
True though. It's good.
Well,
you guys probably don't think about it at all. Like, it sounds like you guys don't have to think about it.
No, not really. For us, our aim was to write songs that we really liked. And we had an idea that other people would probably not like it. But that was, you know, whatever. I mean, we're not going to make money anyway with this.
Mm-hmm. The goal was to amuse ourselves. Yeah,
that's true. Plus, it was especially because Peter and Berend and I had grown up together. You know, we've been friends for like more than 40 years now.
That's so wild.
They're like my brothers.
That's so cool.
So it's easier to communicate with each other. We have the same sense of humor, the same background, ish.
Inside jokes.
Inside jokes. Yeah. So we were all pretty a bit nerdish, nerdy.
And a lot of people have said, well, it sounds like you didn't make any compromise on the songs you made.
No, why should
we? Yeah. The thing is, we didn't know how to. Because these days, we're a little bit better on the instruments and the crafting and all that. So now you have a choice. We could go make it acoustic or like full blast or make it a little bit more country or... or another time schedule or whatever.
We still do this our own thing.
Yeah, but those days it was Carol came up with something and nobody of the guys thought, well, maybe you should change the time structure. None of that. So we just try to play along as good as we could, and then if it worked, it worked, and if not, then.
But it depended on the song, like. Kids Are Right, for instance, the other song. I remember Peter came up with, I think it was, the beginning of the song.
Yeah.
Like the verse.
I kind of ripped that off from Buffalo Tom.
Totally.
Because we were...
Totally. You had to...
Because Buffalo Tom and we had Tom Johnson as a manager, the same manager. Right. And Buffalo Tom played the Milky Way and... obviously, we were big fans because Bird Brain was out. And so, and I thought, well, that's an interesting sound. And those songs are really cool. So I went up to the front and I was watching Bill Janowicz.
His hands.
Because he always, he does a lot of times like G, like the third, the second, and then the C or E minor or whatever. Yeah. And that going down thing. So, wow, that's interesting. Let's rip that off.
right. That, you know, it's funny. I remember I just remember that at the Knitting Factory show, somebody compared you, Peter, to Richard Thompson as far as, which I don't hear, but I do, but I do hear as far as like being this really just like a transcendent lead guitar player. You know what I mean? And again, it really did stand out back then. It's like, this fucking guy rips on guitar. Like, he really stands out, like with leads.
Probably and really loud in the mix then.
Yeah, but and just also that you guys gave room for it. And then also that just the way that you play, where all of a sudden there'd be a really happening nasty-ass fuzz. I also wanted to ask you what fuzz pedal you're using, if you recall.
I recall that stuff,
because you still have it.
But let me get back to what you just said.
Yeah.
Looking back on, for instance, the video that was made at the Knitting Factory, and
it's on YouTube.
Yeah, and I'm really amazed of the guts or the no shame thing.
Going for it, man. Yeah.
Oh, you were really nervous as well.
I was like totally nervous.
We were shaking.
I couldn't eat for like a couple of days before the show. But finally, when we were on, we thought, well, let's fucking kill it.
Yeah. We had nothing to lose anyway.
There you go. Yeah. What was the question again? Yeah. I already forgot.
That you were...
I guess it was more... I was going to get to like... So you mentioned Bill from Buffalo Tom, and I'm guessing like was Jay somebody? I'm just guessing the awesome lead guitar vibe that you had.
The pedals.
If that was something that, on pedals. Yeah. I mean,
Ibanez Tube Screamer and Yamaha distortion pedal, a black Yamaha. Something with 100.
Whoa.
I can look it up if you want to. Yeah.
Just those two.
Tuning pedal, the most important pedal I had. still have.
Oh, yes.
And then, and you were, I recall you were playing a Les Paul, right?
Really piece of crap, because we got money from Brinkmann to... buy decent instruments.
Gear.
Back on. Right. Yeah, the gear and to record the record.
Yeah.
Right.
And I really wanted to have a big sound. So therefore, Les Paul. And I went to a shop in The Hague to buy a Les Paul, but I really wanted the Neil Young, the Bixby on it. And mm-hmm. they said, well, our repairman guy is away, but we can fix it for you. And so I picked up the guitar, and from when I had it, from the first moment on, it was out of tune like crazy. Like, looking at it, it was out of tune. Now, I could be able to fix that myself, but not in right. those days. So it was like right. one song, tuning, half of right. the song, tuning.
Right.
Like, and finally, I got rid of it, and I sold it. Uh-huh. For ridiculously way too cheap, but then uh-huh. later on I got the SE, and that was my thing from then on.
Right, like right.
It's a good guitar.
I remember the Les. I definitely remember the Les Paul, and it's funny. I don't remember the tuning issues, so that's good.
And the way of playing, I remember. Before we even started with the Baddies, I believe, there was a radio show in Holland, and they had a thing, cover your favorite song. And at the time, it was Powderfinger by Neil Young.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I never tried to play like Neil Young or whatever, and I mm-hmm. was figuring it out, and then I thought, I already played it. More were, or less that kind
right,
of way.
Right, right.
You were already influenced right, right. by him.
Or influenced, or that's what your hands do. Mm-hmm. Same in art school. I made those paintings, and everybody said, well, you really like Max Beckmann, don't you? And I thought, who the fuck is Max Beckmann?
Never heard of
him.
And then
from Carol, I got a big book with all the paintings from Max Beckmann, and I thought, fuck.
How long did he... What I was just thinking about the fact that you were saying about the whole point of the band was to not make money and to please yourselves and to live up to your own high weird standards, you know, which to me is the formula of doing a good band, you know, like I think if you're because a lot of bands don't do it that way, you know what I mean? Like a lot of bands have different reasons for doing things, but the idea of like really going in on each other, you know what I mean, and paying yeah. attention to each other and coming up with the yeah. sound is
mm-hmm. as long as you're I just on feel this like planet, that's... better have some fun.
Yeah.
Also, yeah, of course.
By the way, getting back to earlier on,
mm-hmm.
Should not forget that the way we played is also based on Carol's right hand.
It's strumming.
Right. Right.
Your strumming is like at least half the part of what the others play in the band. And for some weird reason, it's always, oh, Peter, the guitar player, but could not have done it without her guitar playing and her strumming. No, it's really true.
I'm very functional.
And it's true. And I guess because Peter's going to get the attention because it's single notes, I suppose, you know, the brrr. But like... You go to school for classical music, but did your guitar playing reflect that at all?
No.
As far as how you approach guitar?
No, I had music lessons in high school. It was like, mm-hmm. you know, Dutch and English was mandatory, and then I had French and German, history and music. And I got my diploma in it. That was my high school. So it was like the history of music, classical music. It was drills. Like the other day, I was watching a movie or something, and I heard the tune Take Five. Oh yeah, Broadway. It's like I hear a tune, right. classical, and bing, it's like 3 times 7 is 21. It's been drilled in my brain. Like I can still recognize certain classic stuff. So no, it has nothing to do with Betty Zavir, but Baron's parents. His father was a famous jazz pianist. He played in New York back in the day in the 50s with Billie Holiday and Bill Evans and
you know,
a lot of people. He was amazing. He died. Mm-hmm. And his mom, before she got kids, she was a jazz singer. So he still has this jazz feel. As a kid, I used to play piano all the time and then started playing drums. So you can still feel and hear that jazzy, you know, sort of leaning
for sure
back into for the into the in songs. You won't find him playing punk rock.
No, it's a huge that restraint and that lightness is a big part, I think, of why Palomine works so nicely, is there isn't this demonstrative banging, and it has a jazz feel. Also, your singing and phrasing is so cool, Carol, because
Thank you. You
also have this cool behind the beat, like the way that your melodies flow over the music is really distinctive and really, really cool and really fun to listen to. And I guess that's just natural.
Because I didn't have a lot of experience. I was playing in bands beforehand together with Peter, but we were always like a tandem. Like he would do the lead guitar and I would do rhythm guitar. But I didn't feel comfortable in singing in front of people. When I was 16, I started writing my first songs, which were completely horrible. So I'm glad none of them were recorded.
Also in the vault.
Yes. No, they are not
one day
recorded. They
that's going to be a hell of a vault.
They are gone. No, it burned down the vault. So I definitely didn't want to sing. I didn't want to be a performer, but I wanted to maybe one day write songs for other artists.
Mm-hmm.
So when we started at Betty Zavira and the whole demo and then, you know, Palomine, I hardly had any experience whatsoever. I'd only been in front of an audience a couple of times. I had no idea what I was doing.
Wow.
And you were totally shy.
Yeah,
I mean, I remember that. I remember also the way that the band presented themselves was in particular was like, okay, there's this charismatic front person who's not trying to.
I was, you know, probably just looking something
yeah,
like this.
Yeah. Which of course made it really cool. It was because it was very real.
It was certainly very real.
Super
for
real.
Me.
Added to the mystery. Not intentionally.
No, I was just scared.
did you grow up with a guitar in the house?
No, I've been wondering where I came from because I'm definitely not adopted, but I don't know anyone in my family. It's like later on I heard after she died that my paternal grandmother had a beautiful voice, a beautiful singing voice, and she would write in Dutch these really melancholic long poems about situations and describing vibes. Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, okay, at least there's one person in my family who is and singing and writing poetry. But I'm the only one. So I'm sort of like the black sheep there, you know, the one who doesn't have job, who doesn't have a mortgage or owns a house,
car,
no kids.
That's so cool. Congratulations.
Yay.
That's awesome.
I'm very happy with my life. But I don't think they don't really take it seriously. No. That's cool.
So, what was the process of making the record? So you, when you made Palomine, did you know that you're making a record for Matador? You knew that you were making it for Matador, and that they were behind it. Is that right?
Yeah,
kind of. Yeah, I remember because couple of years ago, there was this TV series called Classical Albums. And they were making one of Pelamine as well. And they flew to New York and they interviewed Gerard. And I'm not sure if he said it on that TV series or that I know it from somewhere else, but we didn't really have a contract as far as I remember.
I don't think so.
So they asked us and we said yes, but it was never written down. No specifics, no money, no whatever.
I think they wrote it down on a napkin.
I don't
in
recall.
The restaurant.
I don't recall, but
classic.
Possible. Yeah.
That's what I remember.
Yeah. So, but after being invited to New York and that whole week in the knitting factory and Boston and all, we thought, well, better stick with those guys because
that was fun.
That was good. And but nobody made a big deal out of it. It was not like band chasing or big contracts. We want to sign you. We're going to make a five record deal and we're going to make you a star and all that. None of that. So
no. The pressure was off.
The pressure was off and that gave us confidence that they might be the right people. Also, we didn't know anybody else. So.
it's so cool because you put that record on and you had mentioned Uncompromising, but it's also because it's like, yeah, the first song is a long song that eases into it. You know, you're not trying to like blow, you know, like it's very, it's like you're walking into a room as opposed to somebody who's like knocking on your door. You know what I mean? Like with the way that the record.
It's very quiet. Very long.
Yeah. It's not like you have to get into it within the first 15 seconds, otherwise they're not going to play it on the radio.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
We were not thinking about that.
And I guess in that regard, it really is. Yeah, in once again, just indicative of a certain aesthetic that Matador was definitely responding to, which was, we are doing this for us, and you are welcome. You know, we think this is good, and you're welcome to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But we're going to be doing this no matter what. You know what I mean?
Well, honest, I at first I didn't really see the point in making a record because I thought, you know, like a lot of our friends who previously made albums, vinyl. They always got stuck with all these boxes of vinyl. And I was like...
In the attic.
Yeah, in the attic. So now we're going to get stuck with all these records. Who's going to buy them anyway? Yeah. So I didn't really see the point at first. And then Brinkman Records lent us the money. And it was like less than a year after we started it. Very, very fast. So first we made the CD, which was like in the early days of the CD. And we never thought it was going to be turned into an album as well, a vinyl. So by the time Matador said, yeah, but we want to make an album, like vinyl. And we're like, wow. That's when we discovered that we had too many songs on the CD. So we had to take off Brain Tag, because Brain Tag was originally the fourth song. I think After Tomboy, Before Kids Are Right, something like that. So that's there's a lot of discussion between our fans. Some only know the LP version, which has Brain Tag on vinyl.
Seven inch.
We had to take off one song, and it had to be a long one. And it couldn't be a leg because that was the opener. That's the only thing we knew. Like, that's the opener of the record. No doubt about it. But the CD has a different sequence. And the CD sequence is the original one.
What was the thinking when you as a band would be like, okay, leg is the opener. Why?
I remember would leg be the opener? One thing is that we had...
It didn't fit anywhere else.
We had a manager called...
Really?
in Holland, we had a manager called Tana. And one day we were at her house. And Carol and Tana had been cutting out, like the Burroughs way,
titles.
Every title on a separate piece of paper. And we had cassette decks. So yeah. Yeah, so they made the following order of changing those little piece of papers with the titles of the songs on it, recorded that way, listen to it the next day or at night or whatever.
Listen to the whole sequence from A to Z. So going through the whole cassette, and then it was like, nah, wrong.
That doesn't work. Okay, let's...
But then go it again.
It took ages.
It probably took...
How long was that process?
It was like probably weeks? Longer than the whole recording process.
Amazing. Yeah, yeah. I'm like that with sequencing too. I go insane for sure.
Sequence can be very, very important.
I agree. So the record itself was recorded live over how long, or what was the recording process of Palamon?
Two weeks, including mixing. If I remember correctly.
Yeah, or maybe mixing afterwards. Everything was live. Some of the vocals as well.
Some of the vocals were live too?
Yeah.
Well, at least guide vocals.
I think some of the vocals were just used because it was already done. So why redo that?
For the bleed.
What made you decide to double track the vocals on Tomboy?
That's a good one.
We thought it sounded cool.
That's what I think too.
Yeah. We love the effect. Apart from all the bands that we just mentioned, Bjorn and I were Carpenters fans. We're Beach Boys, a lot of jazz standards, you know, Beatles fans. There was so much music that we were listening to.
Beyond big prog rock.
Oh, yeah.
Genesis, yes, and all those bands.
So
Beatles, obviously.
Yeah, so that...
And where does the Velvet sit in here? Because I know that there's some heavy Velvet action in
this. Oh, yeah. We were fans of Velvet Underground. So, I remember the first song that I played it was one of the earlier songs that I wrote in somewhere mid-80s. And I played it for a friend of ours. And he was listening and he was like, this sounds like a Velvet Underground song. And I was like, oh, a Velvet what? I didn't know the band. And he was like, next week I'll bring the record and you'll hear. And my song and the song that he played both started it with a line, here she comes again. There she goes again. I was like, no way. This is not fair. And he was totally right.
It's your Max Beckmann experience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
I thought it was being original. Well, screw that.
Yeah, well, I mean, but that, I don't know. It's to me is always a good sign where you have an idea and it turns out that somebody else cool had an idea too.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
decades ago.
That's like... Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
I mean, and we were big Velvet fans with the Artson, and we did Artson Velvet shows with the Artson
as well. Oh, you covered Velvet Underground.
So I more or less knew a little bit of the... Because it's not really difficult to play as long as your state of mind is all right. But like technically, so I learned a little bit from that we could use into the baddies.
Yeah, true.
Right. So... What happens after the big week? So you have the week in New York. Is the record finished by that point?
No.
Had to be recorded.
No, we.
So you had it recorded when you played at the Knitting Factory.
No, it was not recorded yet. No,
no, that was sort of around late June.
Okay.
That's so handy of this booklet that we just
made. That's good. I know the timeline.
Yeah, it's just got dates.
Okay, so you do New York, that's cool. You do New York, and then you know that you're going to make a record. You go back to Amsterdam, and you start putting the record together.
No, we did a show supporting Pavement in Nijmegen.
Sick. Again, it was such an. You guys had such an interesting vibe because you were grown ups, you know, like you weren't young kids doing this, you know. But at the same time, there was this completely wide open, non cynical, like feel to it.
Yeah,
there wasn't anything like that because, yeah, like yeah, there was nobody like that.
I believe the thing is
like
when you live in New York. Because I remember the first week in New York, with everybody you talked to, everybody was like, had that like thing in their eyes. Because there's so much information that comes to a person who's living in New York. There's always other possibilities to explore. And we were just like easygoing, not a lot happening. Just go with the flow, see what happens.
And we've been living in a bubble, our own bubble of friends,
right. Yeah.
Outside the normal Amsterdam scene and what was going on. We never went out unless it was a band that we liked because we were all dead poor. So
right.
We would have parties at each other's house and bring your own beer.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, but we were on the guest list very many times, especially at the Milky Way.
Yeah.
Because we knew the promoter, and we even got phone calls. Tonight, better show up. Gonna like it.
Yeah, we'll put you on the guest list. So he knew that we didn't have, a dime. Yeah.
And also, compared with the New York or the American bands, we were kind of lazy. No ambition, no career plan whatsoever.
I was working, mister. I was working. No, I had a job.
All right.
When was the last time you listened to Palomine?
Last couple of weeks.
Yesterday, right. I tried, because we might do a show or maybe a couple of shows. I'm not sure yet. So I tried to figure out the chord
Palomine
structure.
Shows,
yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I tried to figure out the chord structure of the song Maggot, which has like two pages of handwritten chords. And it's only like seven chords, or not even. But they change around a lot, and it took me like almost the whole day.
But it's a bonus Amazing. Track. It's not really on the album.
Yeah, but you gotta know it.
But you gotta get it right.
You gotta get it right, yeah, yeah. And it's really funny, because I'm like, what did I do there? And then, oh, well, that's nice.
Rediscovering
the muscles. Because it's a weird muscle memory, right? That's what I found when I go back to things that I have forgotten about writing or whatever. It's like, oh right, I was keeping my hand like this a lot. Or a lot of times it's like it's actually a physical thing that you were doing.
Yeah, you have to shut down your brain and just let your hands take over.
Yeah, but sometimes I have the photo memory that I know, oh yeah, I was like here, not over there.
That's what you're saying.
Right, right, right. Like, right, yeah.
Yeah.
Muscle memory, yay.
But compared to Chavez, the Betty songs are piece of cake.
See, I know, but you know what, this is what I was thinking about is that, because when we had to relearn songs to do stuff, I realized actually for my parts are really fucking easy. Oh, everybody else's parts in Chavez were hard.
Oh,
I didn't realize that until I got more into technically playing guitar kind of after Chavez. Really, I started getting more into stuff and so when I went back, I was like, oh my god, what I was doing is finding like the easiest thing to play and like a through line or something like that. You know, like one really simple thing that was going the whole time, but. Yeah, I was cheating. Everybody else had to work.
Yeah, but it sounded as a whole sounded quite complex.
Yeah, but it was a similar thing where everybody had a lane, you know, and as it turned out, my lane was actually the easiest of the bunch.
It
and
still
Clay,
works.
The other guitar player, was doing a lot of the crazier things than the drums.
Yeah,
okay.
Was there any Are there, I mean, it's hard. There is no right or wrong. There might not be an answer to this, but when you do go back and hear it, is there any kind of like, wow, or sort of some sort of insight where you get to time travel and hear yourself back then and or whatever? Like, what are your impressions of Palomine listening to it now from where you're sitting?
They sound exactly the way they were supposed to sound. I mean, I can, with most of the songs, I can recall the moment when we started writing them, which was always different depending on the song. Like with Kids Are Right, Peter started the first couple of bars. He had the first verse, and then he played it for me, and he said, "Can you make a chorus to it, and maybe do some rap, like instead of singing, rap?" And I don't know how to rap. That's a whole different ball game. I've never rapped him, but yeah, just try to sort of like talk. Sing. I was like,
right.
Okay. So that's why Kids Are Right sounds very different.
Also remember, because that was kind of a challenge from
like no way are you going to be able to do that.
Because you're kind of, it's like tough talk. It's like tough talking.
And then there was the other song, Totally Freaked Out.
You came up with that.
And I came up with that and I said, well, write some lyrics and some melodies for this, ma'am.
I did. Leg, the first song, Peter and I wrote it together on acoustic guitars. I think I was playing a 12-string at the time, acoustic.
Probably, yeah.
So we worked it out, and then we played it for Baron and Herman. It took a couple of weeks for them to figure out because of the changes.
It's almost like four songs in one.
Yeah, but especially in the beginning. So ever since we started playing it with the whole band, we still count in between when it switches. Like two, three, four. You tell me what it is. I have to count. Otherwise, nobody knows.
No.
Where we're going to start. Same with Palomine, actually. We also still count when it switches over in the middle of the song.
But then again, on the album, nobody is in time with the other one, especially with the end of the small Palomine song. The last note is like four people in different...
super wide.
But that's okay. But...
There was a critic, a Dutch critic, who said the band is very, it sounds like a band that fell down the stairs, but all on different moments.
Amazing. That's a compliment as far as I'm concerned.
They didn't see that as a compliment.
Oh, and then also the dog. So what's the story with the Dalmatian on the cover?
The with the bobbing head.
Yeah.
Baron bought it once, I think in London, and he had it on his drum kit, the kick. It was sitting on the kick, and every time we were playing, the dog was like that.
Amazing.
And so we had to come up with a title, and one of the songs was already called Palomine. We needed a title for the record, and we needed a visual. And so we came up with, like, okay, Palomine is a cool word because it was a made-up word, pal of mine. And we were like, okay, but what does it refer to? It's like, oh, the songs are about pals, like friends. It's more about friendship than, you know, love affairs. The dog is sort of like the fifth member of the band already, so why not make a picture of that?
What about the orange backdrop?
I think the photographer friend of ours, Diederik van der Donk, I think he came up with the orange.
Okay.
I think so. Just a big orange thing.
Big orange photo backdrop paper.
Yeah.
Like really big. Because the photo of the inside of the four of us.
The band photo, yeah.
Band photo. That's with that same paper and...
the same background.
You look rather odd.
Yeah, there were a lot of critics were like, how can such an ugly band make such pretty songs?
What are they talking about?
That's what they said in Holland.
Are these all Dutch critics?
In Belgium.
Oh, in Belgium. Yeah, sorry.
So I would imagine that's some sort of competitive nonsense.
No, we just
disguised compliment, I guess.
No, they really thought we were ugly.
That's so funny. That's amazing. Well, thank you so much. Are you satisfied with this with this chat? Did I cover everything okay?
Yeah, I guess so.
Anything else that we should
It's fun to see you after so like
really
20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a minute. Really good to see you.
Say that again.